Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio collector historian Ed Corcoran. I might point out that our program isn't originating from our studios in Hartford tonight, but from Fort Lee, New Jersey. And Ed, who is our special guest tonight?
Well, I'm glad you used the word special, Dick, because we have really one of the most famous of the radio actors, Mr. Leon Janney himself.
Leon Janney, I think, is perhaps one of the most outstanding actors, not only in radio, in the field that we're going to be covering tonight, Leon, but certainly on television, on Broadway, and in the very earliest days, at least, in the motion pictures. Am I right?
That's right. In other words, I qualify for that horrible word, the veteran actor. I am exactly 112 years old.
Born where?
I was born in Ogden, Utah, on April Fool's Day, 1917.
And Leon, you very, very early in your career got into vaudeville. At what age, may I ask?
Well, I first appeared in Amateur Night at 2½. And it was my hometown in the Pantages Theater. That name will have to be, most of our audience has to be well over 50 to remember the Pantages Circuit. And I was an Amateur Night, and I won the $5 gold piece first prize. And my mother had taught me poems since I was able to talk. And that started me. Then I, starting, believe it or not, at the age of 5, I played a boy monologist on vaudeville and then went into the silent movies in 1925.
Must have taken you to Hollywood.
Yes. I happen to be a Hollywood feature motion picture actor, but I'm just in between pictures now.
When was the last picture made that you appeared in?
The last feature picture I made in Hollywood, believe it or not, was in January 1932. It co-starred me and Henry B. Walsall. It was called Police Court. And to conjure up names of the past, it featured Aileen Pringle, King Baggett, and Al St. John. Now that shows I am 112.
It really is reaching back.
But since then, of course, as you know, having been a kid star in the early talkies, playing Penrod in Penrod and Sam, and the title role in Father's Son with Lewis Stone and Irene Rich, and George Arliss's grandson in Old English, The Doorway to Hell, and so on, with Jimmy Cagney and Lou Ayres. I then came to New York and went around closing vaudeville houses, then went on the legitimate stage and did several things on the legitimate stage, then started doing a few radio programs, and subsequently became the star of The Parker Family before I went into the Army. And then I came, I was the star of The Parker Family from 39 to 43, came out of the Army, decided what was I going to do, sit around and wait to make a living as a star, or was I going to go to work as an actor and perhaps learn my trade? And I really learned my trade in radio.
Well, as a matter of fact, you were the original Uncle Don out on the West Coast, weren't you?
No, I wasn't quite the original Uncle Don. No, he was Uncle John.
Oh, Uncle John.
Uncle Don was in New York. No, but Uncle John of KHJ, I appeared regularly on his program, and that's in 1925. And Mary Jane Higbee, as you know, wrote that beautiful book of hers. And in it, she quotes my good night. And would you like to hear it?
Please.
Well, now, they talk about commercialism today, but I think this is a beaut. Every time when I finished, Uncle John would say, well, now, little Leon, will you say good night to our friends? And this was my good night. I said, that was KHJ. May kindness, happiness, and joy be with you all the day. And may the God who loves us all forget not KHJ. God will not fail to watch thy sleep and wake thee with his light. And now, dear friends of KHJ, I wish you all good night.
Bernie, one better.
Well, Leon, let's talk about your radio career. This is the golden age of radio that we are talking about, and really it began in earnest here in New York, I would assume.
That's right. You see, before the war, well, my gosh, when I say the before the war, I've got to explain which war I'm talking about.
That's right.
World War II. I did a few things, like I played the young lead on Hilltop House with Bess Johnson. And, I have to tell one anecdote about Hilltop House. This, it was in, you know, about 1939, 1940, and she was in love with a man named John who had crashed in Brazil and was suffering, of course, that great radio disease called amnesia.
Yeah.
And he was found by a little native girl who was taking care of him. Well, every day, the first half of the program would be Bess at Hilltop House, which was an orphanage, taking care of the children, solving their problems and so on, and worrying about her dear John, whether he was still alive or not. And the second half was, of course, John being treated and taken care of by a little native girl played by Mitzi Gould. So you know that there were at least three people that wrote in and said, "Dear Bess Johnson, it is so painful to think of you worrying about John and where he is. If you will only listen in to the second half of your program, you will find out that he has crashed in the mountains of Brazil."
How long were you stuck there in Brazil?
No, I wasn't John. I was the juvenile.
Well, all right. Let's talk about some of those shows, Leon.
All right.
We're going to take you probably beyond the Great War, then, of World War II.
Well, yes. As I say, when I came out and I decided to be an actor and learn my trade, I started strictly as a juvenile, and then I had been a dialectician because in vaudeville I had done imitations and so on, and have a pretty good ear for dialects. So I began doing dialects, and within no time at all, well, I would say within a period of a year or so, I was recognized as a comparatively talented character actor. And I could play, and I did play, anything from about the age of 18 up to 80, cultured or uncultured, and in any recognizable dialect.
I'm sure our listeners would like to hear, Leon, in an excerpt from your collection, Ed.
Yes, I thought we would start off, Leon, with, a juvenile type of role, The Adventures of Dick Cole, who was a comic strip character, was he not?
I think he was originally. It was designed by a man named Henry Clay Klein, who used to do the Listening Post, which was the Saturday Evening Post strip that advertised the Saturday Evening Post, and they used to dramatize theirs. Dick Cole, let's face it, was sort of a road company Frank Merriwell, but, you know, brought up to date a little bit, but still pretty corny. But I enjoyed it.
And this program was not live, as I understand it. Am I right?
No, that was a recorded show, as a matter of fact. Yes, it was syndicated. It did not go on the networks. It was a syndicated program, which was very early for that type of thing.
Are you ready to wind up the Victrola, then?
Okay, let's let her go.
Presenting Dick Cole and his thrilling adventures at Far Military Academy.
We'll always be near to Far. We'll praise her where'er we are. We'll cheer her each day with a hip hip hooray. It's a rule there's no school like Far. We'll sing out our loyalty. We'll ring out with voices free. As we travel through life, we will follow our star. We'll always be near to Far.
Listen, boys and girls, today we bring you another exciting episode in the adventures of Dick Cole at Far Military Academy. You've known Dick Cole in Blue Bolt magazine and in Foremost Comics for a long time. And now you meet him every week at this time over this same station on the air. Now, here's Dick Cole to tell you something about today's thrilling episode.
Hiya, gang. Our story today is one of the most exciting I've ever told you about. It's a story about bank robbers and about walkie-talkie radios. You all probably know about walkie-talkies. They're the little portable radio two-way sets. They're both sending and receiving that the Army Signal Corps developed during the war. And you know, they're very light and you can carry one easily in one hand. Well, Ted Green, the captain of the cadet corps at the academy, and I have been having a lot of fun with walkie-talkies lately. We've been going out on Saturdays into the fields near Far with a couple of walkie-talkie sets and with a new little radio sound locator that Major Far invented. the way we've done it has been to wander off in opposite directions and then use the sound locator to get our bearings by testing it constantly over the walkie-talkies. Well, we were out a couple of weeks ago making our tests.
Cole, this is Green. Message for you. Over.
Green, this is Cole. Send your message. Over.
The sound locator is working beautifully, Dick. I can see you now from the top of this hill.
Ah, that's swell. I'll keep moving in.
All right. I'll keep on talking.
I've got you beamed on the radio sound locator, Ted.
You're not looking at me, are you, Dick? Because you can certainly see me from where you are now.
Nope. I'm not looking.
What gets me is that it's so simple. It just picks up the frequency that the walkie-talkie uses and then tracks the person who's talking.
Yep. It's just like following a string or a telephone wire.
Well, that's enough of the walkie-talkie, Dick. Here you are.
Wow. Say, again we hit it right on the nose.
We sure did. Dick, do you realize that we were 3 or 4 miles apart when you started using the sound locator?
Say, Ted, I wonder what had happened if you hadn't stood in one place while I was moving toward you. I mean, if you'd been moving around, too. What's so funny?
I didn't stand in one spot.
You didn't?
No.
I'll be darned.
Dick, the locator doesn't care where the person is, or how fast he's moving, or what kind of a zigzag course he takes. It'll find him anyway.
Now, suppose we separate here, Ted. You take the sound locator this time, and after we've each hiked a mile or so, we'll switch on the walkie-talkie radios and start moving toward each other.
All right, Dick. First, we ought to read the memorandum from Major Farr.
Memorandum?
Mm-hmm.
Why, I hadn't heard anything about it.
That's something or other that was being distributed from to the whole cadet corps just as we were about to leave. Well, listen to this. There have been a series of bank robberies in the towns in the academy area during the past few weeks. Undoubtedly, one organization of very clever crooks using scientific methods has been responsible for all the robberies. Let me see. Says that in spite of trap after trap the police have set, the crooks have managed a spectacular series of getaways. The major says that he's promised the authorities that they will have the complete cooperation of the school, and he's asking the boys to keep their ears and eyes open for anything that might lead to the capture of the criminals.
Wants us to play detective, huh? Except that it's serious playing.
I guess that's it.
Well, we can keep our eyes open.
We won't have much of a chance to hunt bank robbers while we're out here in the open with the walkie-talkies, I guess.
Well, you're right about that.
Well, let's test these sets before we separate, Dick, and then we ought to be on our way, I think, huh?
Okay, I'll snap this one on.
All right. I'll go up a few feet and try the other.
Police cars are on Highway 39, so stay clear of that area. Use emergency route 3.
You're not coming through very well, Ted.
I haven't said anything yet. I thought you were a little faint.
Well, I didn't say anything either.
Well, I heard a voice.
So did I.
Repeating instructions. Keep away from Highway 39. Police cars are cruising there.
There it is again.
Obviously, it's somebody with a walkie-talkie using our frequency.
It was a peculiar voice.
The stuff he was saying. Something about staying away from Highway 39. Well, that's the one that leads into town.
Uh-huh. He's said to avoid it because of police cars. Say.
Exactly. The same idea just hit me.
I'll bet it's the bank robbers.
Well, certainly it is. The whole thing's clear.
That's how they've been avoiding police traps. They set some of the members of the gang at strategic places as lookouts. And after they've held up a bank,
they use walkie-talkies.
Yes.
They warn the fellows who pulled the holdup and tell them through the walkie-talkies which roads to avoid and which roads are safe.
Everything is all right so far, boys.
He doesn't know how far from all right he's going to be.
Okay, we've heard the adventures of Dick Cole.
Dick Cole.
We'll always be near too far, no matter where'er we are. And I don't remember the rest of it.
Back right after this.
1975 has been a year of growth for two hometown banking friends and neighbors who have now joined together to better serve you. During this year, the Cromwell Savings Bank has joined with Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank to offer even greater convenience to customers at any one of their 6 locations. An account at either bank is now an account at both. This means that these two hometown friends can now serve your best interest in every banking way. In addition to a number of savings plans designed to suit your individual needs, personal loans, home improvement loans, personal checking accounts will also be available starting January 1st. So stop in soon and apply for your personal checking account. The Cromwell Savings Bank Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has two convenient locations at the corner of Main and West Streets and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics has offices in Middletown at Main and College Streets and also on Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester, member FDIC and equal housing lenders. As 1976 approaches, they look forward to providing even better service to you and your family. Now, once again, back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight is Leon Janney. This is Dick Bertel along with Ed Corcoran, and we're recording from Leon's home here in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And, Leon, let's talk about some of these daytime shows. There certainly was a distinction and perhaps a bit of discrimination, as you pointed out, between daytime and nighttime shows. It was more prestigious to appear on nighttime radio.
Oh, yes, it was. Now, for instance, one of the most prestigious that I used to do regularly, there were about, I would say, anywhere from 6 to 10 of us that played the villains on this one particular show. And it was considered the plum, practically, of all, and that was Mr. District Attorney. Now, that, of course, was a nighttime show with Jay Johnston. As a matter of fact, I must admit that after having been on the show for about 5 years, Jay sort of looked upon himself as the district attorney. And for at least 2 years after the show went off the air, he sort of walked around with the air of somebody that had been defeated for re-election. But I guess, actually, I mean, daytime or nighttime shows, practically every show that originated in New York over the period of, we'll say, from 1945 to 1954, I think practically every one I was on at one time or another. I remember at one point, there was 1 week that I did I did 50 shows.
50 shows.
I was doing 5 soap operas and averaged about 4 of those. That's 20. And 3 of them had live repeats. That made 32. I did the Ford Theater, which was an hour show and took 2 days to rehearse in itself, so I had conflicts. I had stand-ins for rehearsal crossing themselves in the hall. And then during the weekend, I did 10 or 15 recordings of Editor's Daughter, and then I did another one called The Life of Mary Southern that I used to record.
You mentioned the term stand-in, Leon. Now, this was an actor who would read your lines for you while
were
on another show.
That's right, because you see, you got paid so much an hour for rehearsal and then so much for the show. Well, in the early days, it used to be that I would get a conflict. We'll say the rehearsal for a show was 1 to 3, and the show went on at 3 o'clock. I would say to the director, unfortunately, I don't finish working. I can't get there till 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he'd say, well, I guess I can work around that, all right. So, okay, you come at 2 o'clock. Now, the cast would be there at 1, and he would turn and say, oh, Ed, will you, you're not in that scene. Will you read Leon's lines in this? Well, that was unfair because I was being paid that extra hour's rehearsal. So the union itself passed the rule that no one was allowed to read for anybody else. So then I would have to hire somebody, which was only right, and then I would pay him the full amount that I got for that rehearsal hour. Now, although that was not a tremendous amount of money, it helped pay the rent of a lot of actors, and also it gave them an opportunity to be heard by a director that they may never have a chance to audition for or anything. I must tell you a very funny one that happened once. One show that I adored was the entire time that Charlie Chan was on radio, I played number one son. Well, there were only 2 Charlie Chans. The first was Ed Begley, and the second is Santos Ortega. So one day, Ed, there's another actor, I don't know if you know him, Ralph Camargo. He's also an actor-announcer.
Right.
Well, Ralph and I were going to a party this night, so I said, meet me at the studio. And Ed was due back for the repeat broadcast. We went on at 8:15, and we had a repeat broadcast at 11:15. So here is Santos Ortega sitting in the control room, and we're sitting and talking, waiting for the repeat, and suddenly look up, and the clock says 11:14, and there's no Ed Begley. Now, we knew he had a job in between, but he was going to be back. Well, it turned out somebody had lied to him about the time. Big joke. Well, suddenly, we're a minute from being on the air. Ed's script is in the control room, and the director, Alfred Bester, hands it to Ralph Camargo and says, you're Charlie Chan. So he, yes, and like a fire horse, he goes out in the studio, and he hasn't even had a chance to read the script or anything, and the first thing you know is something like, Charlie Chan bid you good evening and warm welcome, and he say, you know, and then comes on a little homily, and that opens the show. Well, he did it and did it very well, and then comes the commercial. While the commercial's going on, Camargo turns to me and says, I don't do Chinese.
Good story. You mentioned something earlier, Leon, which intrigues me. You said that you were sitting over in the corner reading the newspaper because you didn't come on until page 5. What was the actor's life like in the studio when a radio program was on the air?
It absolutely amazed anybody that watched, because here we would be doing highly dramatic shows or something, but if you were off for 3 or 4 pages, you'd sit down and read the sports section or something else. You were completely out of it because nobody was watching you, it wasn't right. Television or anything. And then you'd sort of remember a warning that there was a music cue or something. Well, of course, every once in a while, you might get so intrigued in that paper that you'd miss the music cue and somebody would then begin waving wildly and you'd dash for that microphone and maybe be a few seconds late. But you got a dressing down for that. You know, I've really felt, I'd almost like to say this, and I think it's important to say, that in this country of 200 million people, there has to be somewhere between 10 and 20 million, including the blind and ones psychologically unattuned, and others that whose imagination television does not give full vent to, that would appreciate radio drama, good radio drama, not bringing back, I don't, like, for instance, these things we've heard today, they belong in their era. That's and right. They're sort of fun. They're like revivals of old movies, you know, that you see, that you enjoy as revivals and so on. But there is a place for modern drama on the radio, and I wish that people would write in and say, we would like to hear good radio drama, and perhaps we could bring back maybe even one program to start with that might go on once a week. But I believe there would be a good response to it.
Well, can radio do it, do you feel, as effectively as television?
Yes, I do, and I think they can do straight dramas just as well. But one field that this may titillate your audience a bit is there are many, there's millions of them, including myself, science fiction addicts. Now, the sets and so on are just prohibitive. You can't put that on television. And then what happens, if they do manage to do something, it's not the way you feel it should be.
You know, science fiction brings to mind a particular show that you have in your file, Ed.
Yes, this is one where I don't think Leon himself would recognize his voice. This is really very hard to pick out. It's a show called Parigi's Wonderful Dolls, which was done on Dimension X, which was really one of the foremost science fiction shows of all times. And why don't we let the audience judge themselves which part is being played by Leon as we play this excerpt, because I can't ever tell.
I dare them.
On stage tonight, Dimension X, another in the Wheaties big parade of exciting half-hour presentations.
Now, tonight's adventure into the world of the unknown, the world of Dimension X. The doll shop stood on a quiet Washington side street, not too far from the sprawling Pentagon building. A woman and a child waited outside, the little girl peering eagerly through the window at the dolls inside, and the woman glancing impatiently at her wristwatch, as if expecting someone who was late for an appointment. And there was nothing about the doll shop to warn them that they were waiting to keep an appointment with Doom.
Oh, Mommy, look!
Yes, what is it, dear?
In the window of the shop, the tiny dolls. Oh, Mommy, do you think Daddy will buy me one?
Well, we'll ask him when he comes, dear. He said 3 o'clock on this corner.
I see him, Mommy. There he is.
Oh, Henry, here we are.
Hello, dear.
Hi.
Sorry I'm late.
Well, we've been waiting for you, isn't he?
I'm afraid I'll have to call off the shopping, Elma.
Oh, Henry, we promised.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry. It's just one of those things. You've been the wife of an army colonel long enough to know his life isn't his own.
What is it this time?
Oh, it's more of that flying sphere nonsense. The pilot who says he sighted it last month crashed and was killed today, so the general wants a full report.
Oh, dear, what next?
Daddy!
We'll have a staff meeting at the Pentagon at 3:15.
Daddy, look in this window.
Oh, I haven't time, dear.
Just for a minute, Daddy, please.
Indeed. I haven't time to stop and watch a bunch of 6-inch dolls parading around in the shop. There they are, lifelike, aren't they? Look at that, Alma. Dolls are marching around like a regular review. They've even got their own little band.
Henry, your staff meeting.
Hmm? Oh, yeah, yeah. Guess I've got to run. Now, look, don't go spending a lot of money on that nonsense, Alma.
No, dear.
Bye.
Bye, dear.
Bye, Cindy.
Bye, Daddy. Oh, Mommy, look. The band's going to play. Aren't they wonderful, honey? You know, it's funny. I must have stood on this corner 1,000 times, and I've never even noticed this shop before.
Good evening, children.
Oh, well, good evening.
You talk awful funny.
Hush, Cindy.
Would you like to step inside the shop of Santa Felice?
Well, yes, we would.
This way. Here in the shop of Santor Perigi, creator of Perigi's universal, wonderful dolls, the world of adult reality is blended with the world of child fantasy.
This is a new shop, isn't it, Mr. Perigi?
What is new and what is old? Come, this way. Would you like to meet one of my little ones?
Oh, yes.
This one in the red jacket is Toto. Speak, little one.
Amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
That is nothing for Perigi's wonderful dolls. Listen, sing, Toto. Sing for the little girl.
My name is Toto.
Cindy, listen.
Sing, Toto.
Men are big and tall. Dolls are very tall. When men begin to fall, the dolls will rule them all.
Oh, Toto, what? How do they work, Mr. Perigi?
How do they work? Ah, that is the secret of the great Perigi, greatest of all doll masters. To make an ordinary doll is nothing. To make a perfect replica, that is something. But to make a doll with intelligence, that is the work of an artist, huh?
Well, yes. Well, they must be very expensive.
Madame, when I construct a doll like Toto, I cannot dare to be parted from him permanently. So instead of selling, I rent my little people.
You rent dolls?
Precisely. $10. I have but one request. When you grow tired of my dolls, you must return them to me in good condition.
Oh, Mommy, could we take him home?
Take him home! Take him home! Take him home!
Oh, look, Mommy, look. He's bowing and dancing. Oh, Mommy, he wants to come. Please, I'll take such good care of it, please. Well, honey, we'll have to deal with your father later, but... Well, oh, Mommy! All right, wrap him up, Mr. Breezy. Oh, dear, I have a feeling when your father comes home, we'll be sorry.
Toto, my room is, and you're going to sleep right here next to my pillow. Oh, Toto, don't laugh like that. I'm going to have to teach you some manners. You be quiet, because my daddy will be home soon, and he's a colonel in the army, and he'll bust you to private if you don't behave. You wait here. I'm going to introduce you to my puppy dog, Mr. Blister. Be good now. Here, Blister. Here, Blister. Come on, Blister. Mr. Blister. Yeah, this is Toto. Oh, dear, I don't think Mr. Blister likes you. Stop it, Mr. Blister. Come over here and shake hands with Toto, Mr. Blister. Come on, now. Let's go.
Come over here.
Why, what happened, dear?
Mr. Blister tried to bite my dog. Look how frightened Toto is.
Dogs don't get frightened, Cindy.
But he is, Mommy. He screamed.
You just imagined it, honey.
But he did. He did.
Well, Mr. Blister didn't mean it. You know he's the gentlest little pup alive.
Yes. He's nasty and I hate him.
Cindy, you hurt his feelings.
He tried to bite my new doll and I don't ever want to see him again. Ever.
Oh, dear. All right, Mr. Blister. You come downstairs with me. Come on now. Cindy's angry at you tonight.
I'll kill him.
Why, Cindy, where did you hear a thing like that?
Toto said.
Well, I see. Well, you've had an exciting day, honey. Brush your teeth now and go to bed. Daddy's coming home late, so we'll see you in the morning. Hmm? Good night, darling. Sleep well.
I hate him, Mr. Toto. I hate him.
Hate him, hate him, hate him, hate him. Hate him.
One and one usually makes two, but sometimes two things join together and become one. This isn't new math. It's the all-new combination of Cromwell Savings and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Banks. In an age of expanding and changing bank service, these two old friends and neighbors have joined to maintain the greatest customer convenience for thousands of lucky customers. An account at either bank is an account at both, which means these hometown friends can now serve your best interest in every banking way. Full personal banking service, including checking accounts, available January 1st. But you can begin right now with savings and loans at both, because an account at one means an account at both. So one plus one equals a bigger one. The Cromwell Savings Bank Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has two convenient locations, at the corner of Main and West Streets and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank have offices in Middletown at Main and College and also on Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester. Member FDIC. Now back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest tonight is Leon Janney. Our show is coming from Fort Lee, New Jersey, where Leon makes his home. And, Leon, this is an area that certainly is an infamous chapter in radio's history. The blacklisting, which occurred early 1950s, was that the
That's right. It began around 1950 and lasted to 1957. And, of course, it was triggered off by the late Senator Joseph R. McCarthy of Wisconsin, in which it seemed that almost everybody that didn't agree with his idea of Americanism was labeled a subversive. And it spread like an epidemic disease. And there was a book that came out called Red Channels, in which I think it was about 160 people, and it was their ties with what they considered. It had a microphone on the cover with a red hand grasping it, right, as if it was out of a horror movie. And, of course, this red hand was the communists. And to give you an example of three of the things that I was cited for, and I made two appearances. I was a friendly witness both before the subcommittee on internal security before the Senate and before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And I might add a rather humorous thing is I appeared before the Senate Committee on Columbus Day, 1951, and the other committee on Lincoln's birthday, the House Un-American Activities Committee, on Lincoln's birthday, 1952. When I got subpoenaed for the second one, I had already testified for almost 2 hours before the Senate committee. And I said to the fellow that gave me the subpoena, I said, but this is ridiculous. I have already testified before the Senate committee. If there's any perjury in my statement, you've got me. Otherwise, you've got it all documented. And he drew himself up and said, Mr. Janney, you don't seem to understand. The Senate subcommittee on internal security is a temporary committee of Congress. The House Un-American Activities Committee is a permanent committee, and we do not exchange information. Now, that really is a humorous thing. But now, as I say, I was a friendly witness, and I answered all questions. And one of the things was, for instance, in 1945, I had backed for re-election the communist candidate, Benjamin Davis, for re-election to the City Council of New York. Now, that on the face of it, that's a pretty strong thing. But the thing that people forgot was that William O'Dwyer, who was running for mayor, also backed him. You know, but all of a sudden, I'm a villain, all of my, you know, just it's me. But William O'Dwyer backed him at that time. Then there was a peace conference that was held at the Waldorf Astoria, I think, in about 1949. And I was one, they said, it's a peace conference. Would you care to be one of the sponsors? Well, I think you know, just looking at me, that I'm thoroughly in favor of peace. So I said yes, and I mean, if the doorman of this complex that I live in wanted to get together and have a peace conference, I'd be in favor of it if I thought anything come out of it. Well, unfortunately, as I told the committee, the peace conference wound up spouting the Soviet communist line, and I disavowed it. But it didn't come out in the paper that I disavowed what was the result of the peace conference. All that came out was that I was one of the sponsors of it. But it was people from all over the world, Americans, Europeans, Asiatics, and so on. And the third one was the Spanish refugee appeal. These were the three things that I was, listed in this book for, and which I did not work on commercial radio or television for 5 years. The third one was the Spanish refugee appeal. And this has been headed ever since then to this day by Pablo Casals to help take care of the people who are over the border in France who are victims of the Spanish Civil War. Now, it was called a communist front. Now, because I would not turned to the right wing, I was not welcome, even though I had been a friendly witness, because I still believed in the things that I believed in, which was not including being a communist. And the second thing was that because I had been a friendly witness, there were certain people on the left that would have nothing to do with me. So I sort of sat in limbo, and I was blacklisted completely by the right, and a lot of the left didn't want to have anything to do with me because I was sort of a collaborator. So I had five pretty rugged years there, and if radio had died, we'll say, maybe 2 or 3 years before it did, I might have been out of the theatrical business, to tell you the truth, because I made my living at that time by doing most of the sustaining, and so the people will understand the difference, sustaining are non-commercial. They're put on by the networks or the stations. Sustaining programs on the American Broadcasting Company, the National Broadcasting Company, and the Mutual Broadcasting Company.
Well, I want to get at the heart of this thing, though, Leon. Why were you blacklisted from your profession because of what was happening?
Because at that point, in this country, it was such that they didn't even want someone to make a living who was considered to be, quote, unquote, subversive or even possibly subversive. Someone would say, on a commercial program, can we use Joe Doakes? And I must start right now and say there is no actor named Joe Doakes so that you know I'm not using a real name. Can we use Joe Doakes? And somebody says, well, I don't know. So they'd ask around, and somebody would say, well, I don't know. He's been mixed up in a few things that don't sound so good. Well, just a little thing like that, people would back off in fear. To give you an example, there was a man, perhaps I shouldn't even mention his name, but he was the senior director at NBC. And one day a vice president, and I know this is true, walked up to him with a list of about 200 actors and said, I don't want you to hire any of these anymore. So this director looked at them, and he saw in them about 15 or 20 that he used regularly. And so we'll just use my name as an example. He said, oh, you've got Leon Janney down here. He says, well, I use him regularly. He said, and you don't want me to use him anymore? And the fellow said, no, none of those. He said, okay, he says, I tell you what I'll do. Now, for instance, Leon, if next week I may have a part for Leon, I'll call his message service and leave word for him to call me. He'll call me, and I'll say to him, Leon, I have a wonderful part for you, but I can't hire you. And, of course, he'll say to me, why? And I'll say, well, I don't know, and then I'll refer him to you, Mr. Vice President. Well, of course, the vice president looked at him rather amazed and said, oh, that's the way you feel about it, huh? He said, yes, that's the way I feel about it. He says, okay, forget about it. And that was the end of the blacklist within the company at NBC. That's how ephemeral the entire thing was. You had to think right and talk right. You couldn't dissent. It really was a frightening period.
Well, how did it finally end? What brought it about that you were able to get back onto radio again then, Leon?
Well, what actually did it was, I think, the censoring of McCarthy, which was, I believe, early 55, when the Senate censored McCarthy. Then slowly people began looking around and realizing that the emperor's new clothes, he was actually naked. That McCarthy had really never divulged, in other words, he'd named 285 communists in the State Department. He'd never come forward with one or anything. He had just ridden an anti-communist hysteria in this country, and that people realized their own, their civil liberties and their right to dissent was eroding completely. And it just went up in smoke all by itself.
Well, I'm glad that we did bring out this aspect of the golden age of radio. Let's bring our audience up to date. I'm sure that our audience gets the impression that once network radio disappeared, so did all the actors, and now you're doing something entirely different.
No, that's very interesting. As a matter of fact, now acting is my hobby. I've done several soap operas in the last 10, 15 years, doing different runs. As a matter of fact, I was the first father on Another World, and I must admit, when I got that, Don McLaughlin, who plays the father on As the World Turns, said to me, he said, Leon, I give you 6 months with that contract. I said, what do you mean, at the salary they're giving me to start with and everything? He said, well, you don't understand that this particular writer that you're working for, well, you'll find that the men go off someplace and make a lot of money to make a, so that it's a beautiful house that they live in. But outside of that, they're blithering idiots, and the women solve everything. I said, at this money, I can do it. It was almost 6 months to the day that I went screaming in with a screaming meanie and said, you haven't given me a scene with a man. I sit around being understanding with my wife and my two daughters. My wife solves everything, and I sit there like an idiot. I want out. And he was right. So from then on, I've only played villains, and I've had a ball at it, and comedians, villains and comedians. But as I say, acting is a hobby, is I truthfully make my living with my voice on television and radio commercials.
Well, that's a very lucrative field, as you pointed out, a very important field. Well, I want to wrap up our show tonight, Leon, with an excerpt from a program called
Dimension X.
Dimension X, okay. A very unusual setting. What was the name of the show?
The name of the show was called Eternity Lost, Dick.
All right, Eternity right. Lost. Would you set the scene for
us? Yes, well, it was this man, this scientist, who had invented this massive machine that could take something, let's say, the size of a tank, or a tremendous aeroplane and reduce it in size to where it could fit into a matchbox or into your, you know, into your cufflink, practically. And this was great. You could, in other words, you could transport a whole, you could take people and do the whole thing. You could transport a whole division in a shoebox, you know, 17,000 men and all their equipment. But he'd never taken anything below atomic size. And his son and daughter-in-law, Adam and Eva, were suspect. I think it was sort of a Nazi background in it. Were suspect of being subversive. And he put them in the machine. And then if you've got that part of the thing, it what the end of the even if it doesn't include me in it, the very end when they are when the capsule in which they have gone in and he has through necessity brought down to some subatomic size, when it comes back, it will mean to the audience much more, and it meant to me at the time, much more knowledge of what the phrase that time is relative means. And I can't go any farther. I just want you to hear what it happens on the show.
Switch off.
Jan, Anton.
Yes, sir.
Keep those men.
Yes, Commander.
Oh.
Don't come near the beam.
Fast.
No, this machine is in operation and can kill anyone coming within range.
Shut off that machine.
The machine cannot be shut off until it reaches nadir. A sudden reversal would cause an explosion.
Who are your son's friends?
Please, Commander, let me finish my experiment. I know nothing about my son's activities or his friends. I swear it. I know nothing about politics.
So?
I must stay here until this experiment is finished. It is too dangerous to be left unattended.
Very well. We'll take the American to headquarters. The rest of you, search the house.
Look here, I'm an American citizen.
I demand...
Erickson!
Yes, my dear friend, sir. Have you found him, Commander?
Erickson! You have betrayed me.
I am a member of the League of Loyal Scientists. Your son is the traitor, not I. Have you found him, Commander?
No! We have searched the house. Nothing. They swear the son and his wife escaped before we arrived.
That is ridiculous. They were here when I left. People do not vanish into thin air.
Then where are they?
Right under your nose, Commander.
But
they're in the cylinder, of course, under the beam there. That is the only place they could be. Allow me to handle the controls. You shall have your prisoners in 5 minutes.
All right, Erickson. You take charge of the machine.
You spy, you traitor.
Don't let him touch that dial. Oh, grab him.
You. There.
He has set it for subatomic dimension.
What does that mean?
Whatever is in that cylinder has become as small as the atom.
Then shut it off!
It has almost reached nadir. We must wait 10 seconds, then reverse polarities. The machine has reached nadir. Angstrom 10 to the minus 11. We must now wait 10 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I don't know. Something must have gone wrong.
Alan, look out there.
Why, it's the solar system.
It's coming at us so fast. Look, the sun.
The sun? No, that can't be. Eva, that's the nucleus of an atom. We've reached the subatomic dimension. That sun is the nucleus, and those planets are the electrons revolving about it.
That planet coming up at us. There, on the other side of the sun, I mean the nucleus, it's...
An electron. It's growing in size. We're heading straight for it.
They're coming down on it. They are going to land.
Well, I guess we finally reached the nadir. We haven't shrunk for the past 2 or 3 hours.
Where are they?
I don't know. Somewhere in a valley between the mountains of a huge electronic ring.
It's almost funny, resting on the surface of an electron.
Look. The soil under the floor of the cylinder.
looks like vegetation.
Yes. Moss. Like it.
Open the portholes.
Seven, eight, nine, ten. All right, 10 seconds. I shall now reverse polarity. I see something.
The cylinder?
Yes, there it is. Just a few seconds more and it will become normal size.
A foot high.
Keep that man quiet. Grows very rapidly.
Yes. 3 feet high. Four. Now. There you are, Commander. And in a moment, you will see your prisoners.
Get the door open.
Yes, sir. There is no door, my Commander.
No door? Erickson.
But there must be.
No, sir. Nothing but a gas valve.
You are right. Nothing but violet gas.
That's impossible.
Where are your son and his wife?
We told you they left the house some time ago.
That is a lie. Where are they?
I do not know.
Erickson, open that valve.
Let the gas be poisonous.
We shall see. Open the valve. Very slightly. What is that? I don't know. I seem to hear music inside my head.
So did I.
Apparently the gas produces auditory hallucinations.
Open the valve again. Careful.
We, the people of peace, greet the great scientist, the omnipotent, the maker of all.
I thought I heard a voice.
So did I.
This is the law of our people, laid down by our first father 10 million years ago. But always and ever there be this record of our race. For it is told that thou, in the fruitfulness of time, shall take back unto thee this ark, like unto that cylinder in which the first father and mother of us all came unto us.
I don't understand.
I am the last of our race. And the sun is cold and desolation is upon the face of our planet. But in our time there was majesty and joy and the gleaning of the fruits of the soil. For we have been the people of peace. And life was bountiful for generations until that day came when in thy everlasting wisdom thou didst decree the end of all. Though there were some who wept, we did not query why. For we have been a happy race. We have followed the law of the first father, Alan, and of the great mother, Eva.
No.
And we have builded this ark so that there may be report of our deeds and of the fulfillment of the trust. Hail, O great one, from the descendants of Alan and Eva, hail and farewell.
Good Lord, what was that?
In the Neva, Dr. Wensler, where are they?
They are beyond your reach.
What do you mean?
Don't you understand? All time is relative. 1 year of our time is 1 revolution of the planet Earth about the sun. Somewhere down in the microcosmos, my son and his wife found themselves in an atomic universe.
Of course.
And landed upon an electronic planet. That planet whirled around its sun, the nucleus of an atom, 1 million times in the space of a second. Our second.
Dr. Wensler, what are you trying to say?
That voice we heard is the voice of a human being, the last member of a race whose blood is mine. For in the space of 10 seconds of our time, Alan and Eva settled upon their microcosmic planet and bore sons and daughters and a great and peaceful race that lived and died beyond infinity. And my children, Alan and Eva, who found it, that race, are dead and gone. 10 million years ago. 10 seconds ago.
That's quite a story. Leon, what did that ending mean to you?
Well, it meant to me that obviously there could be forms of life on our planet revolves once every 24 hours. There could be planets that revolve a million times a second. So therefore, any form of life would be a million times a second would be 60 million to a minute times 24 hours a day. That their lifespan might be a tenth of a second in which they have matured, gone to school, gotten all the knowledge they had, and died.
Can we put that story on the radio?
I wish we would.
Old friends, hometown neighbors. Cromwell Savings Bank is now a division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. And together, they serve your best interest in every banking way. Open an account in either bank, and you have an account at both. And beginning January 1st, 1976, you'll get full personal banking service, including checking accounts. Join the family in the main office in Middletown at the corner of Main and College Street, at 846 Washington Street in Middletown, the Midway Shopping Center in Montville, Colchester Shopping Center, Colchester, 327 Main Street, Cromwell, or at the Cromwell Plaza near Kmart. In an age of expanding and changing bank services, Cromwell Savings Bank and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank have joined together to serve your best banking interests in every way. Member FDIC.
Leon Jenny, it's been great fun visiting with you tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Oh,
thank
it's a
you
joy,
so
and I wish we had
you.
More radio. more, not just talk, but radio drama. Let's bring it back.
I'm in favor of that.
Thank you, folks.
Good working with you, and until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
And Shenanda's music.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Sherrago and Dick Bertel.
Benny Goodman Swing School, the Tuesday evening rally of everybody everywhere who gets a lift from the new pulsating music of youth, swing.
The Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in...